people are participating in globalization. Ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Peace, y'all. This is Rod Stars.
This is G1. Together, we Rebel Diaz.
And when we out here in D.C., the DMV, we bump WPFW.
Washington.
Every Tuesday, 9 to 10 a.m., Voices with Vision. You heard?
Understand. We've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW.
Good morning. It's the Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024 edition of Voices with Vision. The show is dense today. Dense but good. In fact, that's what makes it good. I'm Netfer Freeman, one of your co-hosts in the virtual studio with your other co-host, Brother Craig. What's good, Brother Craig?
Hey, good morning, Netfer. Good morning to all of our listeners and our podcast subscribers. Today's show honors the 70th birthday tomorrow of freedom fighter and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll also be raising new voices of people intensifying the people-centered challenge to the genocide against Palestinians and Palestine.
For that, we speak with Veterans for Peace member Jeffrey Alvarez Berger, and we'll hear from the Black Alliance for Peace New York City-wide Alliance member Ewan about the people's pushback there against Black misleaders, and a message mix about AFRICOM and the U.S. Africa Command getting out of Africa. For our freedom fighters, the U.S. held political prisoners languishing behind prison walls. What's the call?
Free them all.
Here and there in the barrios and the favelas, among those who have least, beat hearts of hope, fly sparks of overcoming. That's from Death Blossoms, Reflections from a Prisoner of Conscience by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning broadcast journalist, essayist, author of 12 books, and a political prisoner who has been incarcerated by the U.S. government for the last 40 years. April 24th marks Mumia's 70th birthday, and organizations around the world are taking action to call for his freedom.
Mumia's 70th birthday is an exceptional milestone because he has survived every time the state has tried to kill him. Mumia surviving in the state and setting precedents for others like him makes this milestone that more significant. Lastly, after his recent health crisis and its ongoing impacts, Mumia's pulling through and turning 70 defies the system's conscious acts that are still in motion, bent on silencing him for good. The freedom of Mumia is bound to the liberation of humanity, because we know that when Mumia is freed, all those who are imprisoned like himself, cases will be opened up. Also, Mumia inspires a great many who see themselves as prisoners of a police slave state, We know that Mumia's freedom calls into question the definition of the U.S. constitutional rights for all and the Pledge of Allegiance, meaning of liberty and justice for all. Mumia's health at this present time is stable, but hopefully, as everyone knows, Mumia is facing death by incarceration, like many others given life without parole sentences. This is simply by the ongoing and life-threatening health needs he faces by the medical neglect and abuse of the prison in response to his urgent health needs, especially after having open heart surgery in 2021.
Keep on marching, keep on demanding, keep on working, keep on struggling until he's free and until all of us are free, until justice rolls down like a mighty stream, until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Mumia, we're with you, brother. We're with you today. We're with you tomorrow. We're going to be with you until you walk these streets again.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. Currently, I'm a writer and public radio commentator. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther journalist and radio commentator. He wrote about racism, police brutality, and repression, especially as experienced by the Black community. He was an outspoken critic of the Philadelphia Police Department, who was framed in the death of a white policeman and has been on death row since 1982. Over the years, there has been a growing national and international movement to stop his execution and to free him.
They tried to cage me in all the ways they could. They tried to kill me in the street, you know. And every attempt they made has been a bitter failure for them. And that's why, when you think about it, why are these people so upset that this guy, Jamal, wrote a book? Well, they're upset because now their sons and grandsons are going to be reading about that nigga and about revolution and about the teachings of John African and about the MOVE organization. Well, that's there. So, you know, as long as people is fighting, you know, don't sweat the small stuff. You're doing what's right. As long as people are rebelling against this repression.
Mr. Jamal is a father, grandfather, and husband. He was born into a poor family in Philadelphia. It was in the 1960s, during the emergence of the Black Power movement, that Mumia and hundreds of thousands of Black youth began to develop a broad political consciousness that challenged the national norms of white supremacy.
I was beaten into the Black Panther Party. As a youth in the 60s, I was impressed by the Black Power movement that was sweeping Black America and the Black world in Africa and the Caribbean. So I remember me and a brother named Eddie Jones and a few other brothers, about four or five brothers from North Philly, went to a demonstration in South Philadelphia. It's at the Philadelphia Spectrum, which is a big sporting arena. This was 1968, and it was the presidential nomination of George Corley Wallace III, I think that's his name. He was running for president on the American Independent Party. In retrospect, it's kind of crazy to think that we would go down to a demonstration in South Philadelphia, which is like predominantly white, and protest against George Wallace coming to Philadelphia. But at that time, you know, we believed that it was our city as well. So we did it, and every one of us got our asses kicked by plainclothes policemen. You probably heard the
to tell her I beat you so bad your own mama won't love you. Well, it has a particular relevance to me because as I was laying in the hospital, charged with assault and aggravated assault and beating on a police officer, my own mother walked by me, looked me dead in the eyes and kept walking because she couldn't recognize me. I was beaten, unrecognizable. I was in my mid-teens at that time. From that period, from those experiences, from me having to go through the hell of that and seeing the complete lack of power of people to resist that, I was attracted to the Black Panther Party, you know? Plus, you know, stuff I was reading, Ramparts Magazine, and which turned me on to other radical materials to read. So because there was not a functioning, active Black Panther Party at that time, we founded one and built one in Philadelphia, you know? I was the lieutenant of information. So my function was really propaganda, putting out information in support of the party and about the political situation in Philadelphia. So I like to say I was beaten to the Black Panther Party. Yeah.
Trained by the Black Panther Party as a revolutionary journalist, Mumia left in the 1970s, where he published and broadcast challenging and critical pieces on the Philadelphia Police Department and Mayor Frank Rizzo.
The Rizzo years were years of police brutality. The Rizzo years were years when brutality reached epidemic proportions and became internationally infamous.
Stopping African American driving cars, it was beating prisoners, it was beating prisoners in handcuffs.
That this agitation's been going on for weeks. And something should. I'm not critical of the school board. I'm sure they have a difficult job, like we police. And I'm sure that they're doing their best. And I'm sure that they're going to try to correct it. But let's just talk about Palmer and Mathis. For weeks, they've been in the areas of schools, inciting kids. Black power this, black power is beautiful. What did the school board do about it? They should do something about it. And I'm hoping they do. But I'll say this for the record. The Philadelphia police are going to do their job. That I promise.
Beyond the brutality and murders, the pervasive use of police frame-ups, planting evidence, perjury, bribing witnesses was the order of the day in Philadelphia during the 70s, 80s, and also the 90s.
His writings conveyed an interpretation of the daily reality of an entire community under siege and terrorized.
It is the analysis that he promoted with that weapon called the pen that was produced by his mental framework, which was a gift from God, that made him a threat and a soldier in this war that we are still engaged in today.
Mumia's articles were now appearing nationally in the Black Panther Party newspaper, which was one of the most widely published, sold, and read newspaper in the black community. The entire world was now tapped into Frank Rizzo and his regime in blue. As a private individual exercising his rights of free speech, he was marked and filed as an agitator to be followed, reported on, and surveilled by the government.
Throughout the Rizzo years, the mainstream media ignored police brutality. There was a study done by Laureus Group in 1970 that said that the city's daily newspapers, the two largest ones at the time, the Inquirer and the Bulletin, deliberately took just the police version of events. There were a handful of journalists who courageously covered it, black as well as white, one of whom in the late 70s was an eloquent journalist, one who had been a reporter for much of his life, a gentleman named Mumia Abu-Jamal.
It is the analysis that he engaged in that made him a threat to the system. And so the conspiracy emerged. And it emerged back in 1968 or 69. And they looked at this young brother
And they said, if we don't stop him, we're going to have a problem. So they waited and waited and waited, just like birds of prey, to the appropriate time. This is an enlarged photo. They call him Wesley Cook, we call him Mamiya. Of Mamiya back in 1972. Another photo of Mamiya as a Black Panther. Let's get to the heart of it. This is a document that reflects a request that was made by the FBI back in 1972 for this photo. And guess who that request was made to? The Philadelphia Police Department. These two go together. The photo that I showed you, now this is the real significance, the back of the photo back in 1972. At the bottom of this photo are written four letters. D-E-A-D. Dead. Even back then, the FBI was involved in this conspiracy, and they are still involved in this conspiracy.
What happened the day this tragedy occurred? Picture yourself on that Philadelphia street corner in the early hours of December 9th, 1981. The area is bustling with nighttime activity. Your attention is drawn to the scene of a Black man pushed up against a Volkswagen being viciously beaten with a flashlight by a white police officer. Suddenly, the police officer is shot. Another Black man approaches the scene and is himself shot by the officer. No less than five witnesses who were at separate locations, unknown to each other, saw someone run from the scene. At least two of them said the person who shot the cop fled. Mumia Abu-Jamal was the man shot by the cop. When police arrived moments later, he was found sitting on the curb near the wounded officer, himself bleeding and gravely wounded.
Prosecution's case is based on three legs. First, they say we had three eyewitnesses. Secondly, they say we have the gun. And thirdly, they say we have a confession that Mumia confessed. We don't have it in writing, but we have an oral statement that he allegedly made in the hospital when he was brought there having been critically wounded on that night. But there was a problem with it. Mumia was under guard, of course, and he was handcuffed behind his back. And he was so weak that he had to practically be carried. But there was one officer who was with him all the time at his side, and that officer filed a report that night, a report of his activities having been with Mumia the whole night. And what did his report say? His report said the male Negro made no statements. Well, the defense wanted to call that witness. And so it was written on his report that he is not to be permitted to go to vacation during the trial. No vacation. And when the defense went to call him, the judge said, well, wait a minute, we have to locate him. And Judge Sabo said to the prosecutor, well, maybe he's on vacation. The prosecutor said, I'll check. The prosecutor went out, made a phone call, came back and said, Judge, you're right, he's on vacation.
Dr. Anthony Coletta was the emergency room physician who treated both Officer Faulkner and Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I would make it clear that I was with Jamal
from within a moment or two of him being brought into the emergency room. Throughout his entire time in the emergency room and on into intensive care unit, and he neither made any confessions to me, nor did he say anything that would be even remotely in the way of a confession to any other individuals.
So the police create their own history. And this brutal police department in the city of Philadelphia created its own history.
So to end, we have various cities locally and internationally hosting Mumia's 70th birthday of resistance. His birthday is on Wednesday, April 24th. We have buses leaving from Boston and New York City to the Philly birthday action, which starts off with a march and rally at 2 p.m. and a few hours later, a evening program. Call the New York bus hotline at 212-330-8029 and visit freemumia.com for more info. Contact the Boston bus by emailing staff@blacklivesmatterboston.org. Also for more info. To know more and to stay in touch with the work to Free Mumia, please email bringmumiahome@gmail.com and check out freemumia.com, also prisonradio.org, and Mobilization for Mumia. That's mobilization with a four, Mumia.com. And also check out the campaign to bring Mumia home, Twitter and Instagram pages. I am Sophia Williams with the Free Mumia Movement, the About the People broadcast, the Spirit of Mandela various subcommittees, and the Kamal Siddiqui Freedom Campaign. None of us are free until we all are free. Free Mumia, free all political prisoners, free them all, and free Palestine. Thank you.
Join PACA, Pan-African Community Action, at the Black Workers and Wellness Center or online Wednesday, April 24th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time to unpack together excerpts from Mumia's writings, listen to segments of his broadcasts from prison radio, and discuss the broader struggle to free all political prisoners. Once again, that's Prison Radio, Lessons from Mumia Abu-Jamal, Wednesday, April 24th, 7 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center, located at 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C., across the street from the Anacostia Metro Station. To join online, register at tinyurl.com/AfricansStudy. That's tinyurl.com/AfricansStudy. For Pan-African Community Action, I'm Toby Anekwe. We hope to see you there. And remember, history is on the side of the oppressed.
Black in Gaza. As the ruinous war continues to rage in Gaza, Black and Palestinian scholars continue to tell the untold stories of these oppressed peoples. One such scholar is Greg Thomas, the founder and editor of the journal Proud Flesh, and author of several books on Black gender and post-colonial studies. In a remarkable recent article posted online, Thomas scripted an eye-opening account of Black revolutionaries and their connections to Palestine. In an article entitled Comrade George, Gaza, and the Black Community, dated March 27, 2024, Professor Thomas recounts the life and present struggles of George L. Jackson, who had the unique distinction of being named Field Marshal of the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party from prison. George Jackson was assassinated in California by prison guards on August 21st, 1971 at San Quentin State Prison, ostensibly because he was trying to escape. In posters both online and in the Gazan streets, the smiling visage of George gazes out from a front page resembling the layout of the Black Panther newspaper, backed by a red blazing field that looks like fire. Next to his face, a fist is raised with a tiny tattooed flag of Palestine on the skin beneath the wrist. Thomas's article is accompanied by a splash of color photos of beautiful black boys and girls, most smiling in a brilliant sun. But there is bitterness amidst the beauty, for these children are sitting atop the shattered ruins and remnants of their homes. Why shattered? Because their homes were bombed by Israeli pilots in August of 2022, just days before Thomas was due to present his exhibition at the YMCA of Gaza. A week later, his exhibition, supported by his Palestinian collaborators, went on as scheduled, and it was a smashing success. Palestinian scholars, artists, journalists, and scribes filled the seats, fascinated at this story of black revolutionary George Jackson. This exhibition was shown in Gaza, in the West Bank, and in the Old City, Jerusalem, and its hosting space was the African Community Hall, which turned on Thomas to his study of the Afro-Palestinian community there. From whence comes this community? From all parts of Muslim Africa. Palestinians, historians say, many came during the Mamluk Wars in Egypt when slave armies rebelled against the Ottoman Empire during the late 1700s and early 1800s. Those photos of Afro-Palestinian children could have been taken in Baltimore, in Harlem, or in Oakland. Former Black Panther leader Huey P. Newton visited Syria, Lebanon, and the West Bank in 1980. In 2016, the party's former Minister of Culture, Emery Douglas, joined a 19-member delegation to Palestine to show solidarity with Palestinian people and their struggle for national liberation. Douglas also collaborated with Palestinian artists to create new works of art of resistance. The exhibition in Gaza, by the way, curated by Professor Thomas, was entitled George Jackson in the Sun of Palestine. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
You're listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart on your Jazz and Justice station. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Veterans for Peace is continuing a hunger strike started by an active duty soldier on Easter to protest U.S. support for the Israeli settler state's genocide against Palestinians. You might have heard the story on Democracy Now! When they interviewed Airman Larry Herbert, who went on leave and started a hunger strike in front of the White House. To update us on that story and tease out more, we're speaking with Jeffrey Alvarez Berger, a relatively new member of Veterans for Peace, but is an 82-year-old Vietnam-era veteran born in Chicago. He's worked as a computer professional, as an assembly line worker in an auto plant, and as a bus driver, and has spent many years as a student. Mr. Berger, welcome to Voices with Vision.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by explaining the reasons for this hunger strike from your perspective and what you hope to accomplish.
It's to stop the genocide in Gaza. And of course, the U.S. is supplying bombs and political cover for Israel as they carry out this campaign. They're obviously just trying to expand and grab more territory. So our main demands are right now, stop the supplying of arms to Israel and stop providing political cover to Israel. Call for a ceasefire. Of course, the long-term solution is a free Palestine.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you're on your 11th day of the hunger strike, is that right? And others have been on the strike for as long as 20 days. What's been the impact of this strike on thus far?
So actually no one's been on this strike for more than 10 or 11 days at this point.
Oh, I see.
The entire length of the strike has been for that long. Yes, you're right. But the effort really began with Aaron Bushnell, the airman who immolated himself in front of the Israeli embassy. And that was a courageous act of defiance for many of us. Larry Ebert was already struggling with the question of what he was going to do. And Aaron's acts spurred him directly into action. So the results so far. So, you know, we have to be clear about two things, I think. And that is support for Israel is bedrock to America's approach to the world right now. We're supporting Israel's colonial expansion there. That's the first thing. The second thing is, right now it's obvious that the majority of people in the U.S. do not support that policy. We know that from our conversations. We see that in polls. We see that through the actions of Aaron and Larry. We need a massive movement. And our fast, it's an important part of that process of ending that, but it's not the whole thing. But the fact that the fast is going on, it presents to the people who come to the White House a daily presentation of the fact that here there are people opposing at the White House, which is kind of a shrine of the U.S. So I think that's just symbolically and emotionally, that's an important thing. And it also gives us an opportunity to connect with others and to point out to them other activities they can get involved in, ways they can deepen their knowledge. We can answer their questions. So we're building a movement. This is a long process.
Mr. Berger, what can you tell us about how this issue has affected the rank and file of military? Do you have any idea about the level of dissent or consent that exists amongst, you know, currently active military people?
Well, probably just about as much as you, maybe a little more. But the fact that Aaron and Larry stepped forward is certainly one indication of that, because Veterans for Peace was publicly supporting Larry. They have received information from other active duty people. Larry has indicated, of course, that he knows of other people questioning what's going on. That's all the information that I have.
Okay. And then you mentioned that you're in front of the White House, that you interact in daily with the public, answering questions, and of course, you know, presenting this protest to people that will then carry that information all around the United States as they return back to their homes. Can you tell us a little bit about what Veterans for Peace is doing, maybe in addition to that, to politicize people that are enlisted in the U.S. Military and, you know, and the general public as well?
Well, I don't have much current information. In fact, I don't have any current information exactly about that situation. Veterans for Peace has a national leadership and then a lot of local chapters. And the chapters pretty much make up their minds what they're going to be doing. And I'm from Minnesota. To my knowledge, there's no active work being done there. But the work that we're doing generally to politicize the issue for the general public, it also politicizes people in the military. So there's an indirect effect there. But we're not doing anything actively. It's fine work to do, but we're not involved in it. I'm not involved in it.
A lot is put into portraying and promoting the United States military as an extension of U.S. benevolence in the world. Now, I know you're a relatively new member of Veterans for Peace, but you have a lot of experience in the world. So how is your perception and even the perception of people, what you've seen in general of the U.S. role in the world been impacted by this issue?
Let me give you some history about my experience first. So I was in the 25th Infantry Division between 1962 and 1965, and our division was getting ready to go to Vietnam. I was paying attention to what was happening, and I was opposed to that war before we went in. In fact, I even told my first sergeant that I would refuse to go with the division if the division shipped. And the division was beginning to send people. There were detachments, people going over for short periods of time as helicopter gunship gunners, and then coming back. At one point, they sent off the engineers and then the artillery, and it was clear that the rifle companies were going to go next. So we could all see what was going on. Since I had decided to refuse to go, I started looking for support. I connected with, first of all, the Quakers. The division is in Honolulu. I'm sorry, it's not in Honolulu. It's in Schofield Barracks, in the center of the island. But I connected with the Quakers in Honolulu and then with the Buddhists. But I was actually discharged, fortunately for me, before the division shipped. After I was discharged, I got connected with the anti-war movement, and I spent a lot of years with them. So as far as the perception of people in the U.S. and what's going on in Gaza right now, the U.S. is an imperial power in decline, and the military is the big hammer that the U.S. is using. There are all kinds of other things that it's got out there, but that's kind of like the fundamental tool. And I think what's going on in Gaza right now, it shows the desperation of the elites to hold on. That desperation is terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that insight. We were speaking with Mr. Jeffrey Alvarez Berger, a member of Veterans for Peace, who's currently involved in the hunger strike to protest U.S. genocide. Well, I guess it is the U.S., but it's also basically the state of Israel, the U.S. support for the state of Israel's genocide against Palestinians. Thank you so much for being on Voice for Vision.
Thank you for having me.
Is a clip directly from a disruption that occurred last Saturday at National Action Network, which is an organization that Al Sharpton is the president of. They were having their annual gathering. And the purpose of the annual gathering was to basically look at the state of Black America, or should we say Black activism in America. And they were like supposed to be organizing a space for people to talk about it. Problem is, Al Sharpton was inviting Representative Hakeem Jeffries to come and speak at this event, and he wanted it to be like this va-va-voom, this is my grandson, I'm inviting him to come speak, I'm so proud of him, he's going to be the Speaker of the House, which is something that he kept emphasizing over and over again. The problem is, you know, Hakeem Jeffries, just as a person, he's taken over $1 million from the Israeli lobby. He's advocated for the occupation of Haiti, which was really at the root of why I showed up there.
Black Alliance for Peace, New York City-wide alliance member Edwin
I very much care about Palestine, and I'm very much advocate for Palestine. But specifically, my issue is that this whole event really was organized by two people that are, it's very clear that they're in support of U.S. imperialism. I think one thing that's often lost on people, because Al Sharpton always calls on his civil rights past or the things that he was able to gain for himself in terms of notoriety through the civil rights movement. I think my main critique for people like Al Sharpton is that, you know, the civil rights movement was and is a movement, meaning like it's moved on from the civil rights era. And I think he constantly calls on the energy of the past to try to give himself relevance. But in our current moment, I don't think that platforming politicians like Hakeem Jeffries, who advocate for the occupation of Haiti and who are completely ignoring the genocide of Palestinians, is really in line. And the video, which you see me at the beginning being shoved away by five of his men, at the core of that was like right before that happened, there were three other disruptions that had occurred before me. And Al Sharpton got up on the stage and really incited people to violence. And he, in many ways, made them like get rah-rah towards people that were disrupting. He had called us rent-a-coons. He was saying that we were there because people were paying us to be there and to disrupt, and he was encouraging us to continue to disrupt as if he was going to come off of his podium and do something. It was all very strange and like we were in a different world, because while we were disrupting, he was having the audience cheer no justice, no peace. How are you? We're talking about genocide. We're talking about the impending occupation of Haiti and Haiti, the determination of the Haitian people. And you're having your audience shout no justice, no peace to that. It really didn't make sense. And I think it really showed that where we're at as a society is completely different from where a lot of these folks that come and preach to us about what's right are at politically.
What if you use the guise of democracy and diplomacy to do the bidding of a racist, white supremacist,
imperialist?
This is all relevant to the conditions that we face, because what we see in people like Hakeem Jeffries and like Al Sharpton is black misleadership, which is a huge issue here in the United States. If we're going to bring black people onto a collective movement for the black freedom struggle, then we have to get real and honest about who's actually leading us somewhere. People like Al Sharpton, people like Hakeem Jeffries, they call on their diverse identity as a means to an end. They say, because I am black, this is why I have a right to say this, or this is why I have a right to organize these people along. But we don't look any further, because if we looked any further, we would see that about a week earlier, Al Sharpton attended an event at the White House where, you know, he was around all of these political elite, and he had the nerve at this same event, at this same talk, to call on the fact that he had Biden, who he had said was so busy, come and do he did a Zoom call in to wish Al Sharpton the best for this event that he was hosting, blah, 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 blah. I think what's interesting is that when the disruption started for Hakeem Jeffries and Al Sharpton took the stage, he was calling us all rent-a-coons. He had actually mentioned, oh, like we had all these white people come here, like Kathy Hochul, et cetera, and y'all didn't have anything to say, but now y'all have something to say for Hakeem Jeffries. And the truth is, we would have had something to say for them too, but all these big political elites that you invited to come speak at your conference that is supposed to be for the advancement of black people, allegedly, all those people you had come, you moved them around on the schedule, so we didn't even know when they were gonna come. But best believe we had smoke for them too. And Linda Thomas Greenfield, who was somebody else that you had come to your little, you know, event with black people in high places. So at the root of it, or the question that you had asked was really, how does it relate? It relates because black people in the United States have to see our freedom tied to black people elsewhere in the world. In Haiti, for instance, Haiti is such an important place when we talk about the history of black people in the Americas, because it is the Caribbean and the Americas were where the slave trade was kind of occurring. They were trading folks back and forth between the Caribbean and the United States. And when the Haitian Revolution broke out, it was really a time where we had saw, you know, they were saying, you can't fuck with us, pretty much. And it put a wrench in what was occurring and had actually led to the conclusion of the slave trade. So when we talk about the conditions of Black people in the United States today, I think we really have to consider ourselves connected to something larger than ourselves. And this movement for Black liberation to exist outside of Black people in America, because collective liberation is ultimately what's going to get us to our goal. And I think it's important that we are critical of Black leaders like Al Sharpton, that we are critical of Black people in high places like Hakeem Jeffries, because at the end of the day, we don't want to be winners of the same system. We don't want to just get what these white people have. We want something that benefits us. We want something that moves us along. I can't say having a Black person in a high place is helping me fight poverty. And I think more Black people, and we need to bring more Black people to this particular understanding.
For $14 billion to kill people in Gaza, they murdered 14,000 children.
People together, others.
Here you go.
To talk about the head of the U.S. Africa Command, General Michael's response to the senator's question.
Talk about why we care about what's happening in Africa right now. I mean, what if you tell the American taxpayer, why are we there? Why are we spending the money we're spending there?
Thanks for the question, Senator. For access and influence, I'd say that a number of countries are at the tipping point of actually being captured by the Russian Federation, as they are spreading some of their false narratives across Libya. And from a strategic answer piece, access influence across the whole Maghreb, that is NATO's southern flank. We need to be able to maintain access and influence across the Maghreb from Morocco all the way to Libya. The PRC and Russia are also remaining exploitative where possible and coercive when necessary. They want that ground. They want power projection capabilities. So for the most part, the rest of the continent is also for mining concessions, whether it be gold or rare earth minerals. Both of them have a long-range plan. But I think at the accelerated pace, the Russian Federation is really trying to take over Central Africa as well as the Sahel.
The first thing the general said was that they need, by they I mean the U.S. need, access and influence in Africa. That is why they are moving the way they're moving.
Better get your hands up.
Yeah. Those who do not move do not feel their chains, but the African people aware of the pain, aware of the game, invader deception, Black presidents who are white man extensions, people from Cape to Cairo rebel, cause fake independence and ongoing hell, colonial ties still keep them chained, the richest continents getting robbed again, the IMF and World Bank criminal schemes, what about reparations? To me it seems that every metropole from Amsterdam to Paris and Brussels was built with the hands of African labor, a slave relation, developing Europe at expense of the nation. But Africans rebelled from the first conquest to flag independence at last accomplished.
You better get your hands up.
You better get your hands up.
You better get your hands up.
Africa.
The Black Alliance for Peace's Africa team and U.S. Out of Africa network commend Niger for its decision to expel the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM. We urge all African nations to reject U.S. neocolonialism and remove AFRICOM from their territories. AFRICOM's presence has led to an exponential increase in terrorism, with more civilian casualties resulting from AFRICOM strikes. Niger's National Council for the Safeguarding of Our Homeland, CNSP, has declared the U.S. presence in their territory illegal, highlighting the erosion of Niger's sovereignty since the establishment of U.S. military bases in 2014. Despite Niger's declaration, the U.S. refuses to leave, dismissing Niger's position as Russian influence. Local organizations in Niger have openly denounced U.S. interference in the country's ongoing transition process, and the people have demonstrated in front of the U.S. Embassy in Niamey to demand the immediate departure of AFRICOM. The U.S. Out of Africa network emphasized the need for African people to control their continent's destiny, and we oppose all foreign military and all forms of imperialist intervention in Africa. The Black Alliance for Peace also expresses concern over AFRICOM's plans to expand by placing new drone bases in Benin, Ivory Coast, and Ghana. We denounce such expansions and call for an end to all military agreements between African nations and the U.S. The Black Alliance for Peace Africa team and U.S. Out of Africa network will closely monitor the unfolding situation in Niger and the Sahel. U.S. Out of Africa, shut down AFRICOM.
Mother continent where we all originate. Eugenics ain't dead, so it's cool to eliminate humanity's darkest shade. Genocidal AIDS, ancient civilizations, not a continent of slaves. And every step of the way, the elites have helped pave the way for all the madness that we're seeing today. But that in no way excuses the centuries of rape. But if we're gonna solve it, it's an issue we have to face. Because every brother ain't a brother just cause of their color. Look at the hand that killed Patrice and Thomas and others. While millions murdered in the Congo, we don't make the news. But if a footballer's wife should buy a pair of shoes, I'm supposed to give a fuck? Apparently I do not. The world's a reflection of your block. And if you think a world that profit from African death and be totally cool thinks you're better cause you live here, you're a fucking fool.
That's it for today's show. This show included audio from Millions for Mamiya by Deep Dish TV and the song Get Your Hands Off Africa by Marcel Cartier featuring Akala and Nana D. Our thank you to Africa Diaspora News Channel for use of that audio. Thank you for listening. Remember to tune in to Voice with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
Remember to make it out to Panka's Asada Shakur Study Group session, Prison Radio Lessons from Mumia, tomorrow, April 24th at the 1DC's Black Workers and Wellness Center across the street from the Anacostia Metro Station. You can follow me, Netfa, on X, what used to be Twitter. That's Netfa Free. That's N-E-T-F-A Free. And don't forget, you can also listen and subscribe to Voices with Vision as a podcast on iTunes or Player FM. Just search for Voices with Vision WPFW. Keep it locked right here for Crossroads with Rose Brennan and Kichi Taifa. Make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people. Or fall back.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. We are L-I-B-R-B-G. We live F-R-E-D-I-E. We lace music with cold, just something to bring us closer. Kick troop the young black youth like we supposed to. No swine in our Rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cent and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got and they on borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We score the soundtrack to this movement. Y'all just rap, brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot with Sebley's boy in the back, Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back, San Kofa right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black, black, black. It go F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to rob for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. Come on. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to rob for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whisperers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Sego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Kane.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
Economic, political, and military decisions in Washington, D.C. impact this entire country and world. And yet corporate media offers few facts, history, or people's voices about these important issues impacting our lives. I'm Esther Ivarum. Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, here on WPFW 89.3, Fridays at 10 a.m. We cover local, national, and international social justice activism, including those who come to D.C. from across the nation or from across the world to speak truth to power. Whether it's the war machine, climate change, the movement for black lives, healthcare, education, the economy, housing, voting, corporate power, immigration, criminal justice, or environmental justice. Check out On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, Fridays at 10 a.m., here on your station for jazz and justice.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Still
still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place. Every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m., Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra